Do you ever struggle with remembering details from your travels? Then I've got something special for you. How would you like a better way to keep track of all the things you see and experience in Scotland? A way to keep those special memories and all the details fresh for years to come? My new Scotland Travel Journal might just be what you need. It includes daily journaling prompts to help you start writing about your day, lots of space for doodling and notes, prompts to reflect on your trip overall, and suggestions for things to do that help you make more meaningful connections with Scotland. There's also inspiration for your travel bucket list, a map to draw your route, space to keep track of your travel details, and some Gaelic and Scottish phrases to try while you're here. All you have to do is print out the journal, fold the pages in half, and start writing. The Scotland Travel Journal is the perfect companion for your upcoming trip to Scotland. Find it in the Watch Me See online shop or visit the link in the show notes. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello there, and welcome to Wild for Scotland, a podcast full of immersive travel stories from Scotland. I'm your host and storyteller, Cathy Kamleitner. Wild for Scotland helps you connect with Scotland, its people, wildlife, landscapes and histories. In every episode, I either whisk you away on a beautiful adventure or introduce you to inspiring locals and their stories. In between, I share my top tips for your own Scotland trip and how to follow in my footsteps. So lean back and enjoy. Let's travel to Scotland. Happy International Dark Sky Week. Yes, that really is a thing. And as chance would have it, this week-long celebration of our night skies starts today. To be honest, I find the timing a little weird because we just changed to British summertime over the weekend, which means our days feel even longer now, which in turn makes stargazing really difficult. But I guess any month is a good time to focus your attention to the night skies, whether you'll find twinkling stars or everlasting daylight. I love stargazing and thought this week would be a great opportunity to revisit a story I wrote for the podcast back in season one. It's called Day and Night and tells the story of my very first trip to the Isle of Col. We start with a boat journey from Tyree to the Cairns of Col and end with an evening spent trying to capture the night sky. At the end, I recorded a new tips section with more information about dark sky places in Scotland, tips for stargazing, and night sky events you may want to look out for. And now, this is Day and Night. I'm sitting on a rock, my back warm from the sunshine, my face cool from the soft breeze that is blowing this morning. I watch the seaweed gently swaying in the water. The sea is calm, but the push and pull of the tides is strong enough to create soft movement on the surface. I can see different kinds of seaweed, some greenish-yellow with frilly leaves and long, yellow, air-filled bladders. Others green like olives and perfectly sphere-shaped air bubbles on the leaves. In between, long and thick brown kelp floating from side to side. I'm mesmerised by the never-ending movement, yet listening closely to the sounds carried across the sea by the wind. I'm waiting for the arrival of a boat to take me away from this island and on to the next. There is a pier nearby,
Only one boat is tied up next to a concrete wall. On the slipway, creel baskets are stacked up tall, drying in the sun, waiting for the day they would be used again by the local fishermen. At last, I hear a distant humming in the air. It's growing louder. I get up and jump from rock to rock, making my way to the pier. I can see the boat now as it is approaching the jetty and know that my ride is here. I may be leaving one island behind, but my adventure has only just begun. I get aboard. My skipper is John. He has travelled the world with his job, but he recently retired and returned to his home island to start a small business. He tells me that even though he's seen some amazing places around the world, he wouldn't want to live anywhere but Cull. My excitement to see it for myself grows exponentially. As we leave the sheltered waters of the harbour behind, the wind picks up. Wrapped up in my jacket, scarf, a woolen hat and sunglasses, I try to brave the cold temperatures out on the open deck of the boat. And my efforts pay off. A few minutes later, John cranks the boat to a halt. He has spotted something in the water and is pointing towards the rocky shoreline. For a few seconds, I see nothing. Only black seaweed covering the rocky outcrops of the island and small waves crashing into them. But then, a round black dot pokes out of the water. And then another. And another. I see a sleek, grey body with dark spots dive up and down again. More heads are coming out of the water now, and they're moving closer. Grey seals. I've seen them before, but usually they bask on a rock in the sunshine and are either startled by my presence or not fazed at all. They either make a run for it below the surface or stay exactly where they are, not moving an inch. I've never seen them being so inquisitive. There are now 10, 15 of them, heads bobbing at the water surface, their eyes fixed on the boat, my camera fixed on them. After a prolonged stare-off, they seem to lose interest, and we move on. John started his business, I'll Go, when he returned to the Isle of Cull for his retirement. Never one to sit idle, he made it his job to show others the beauty of his island. Together with his sons, he runs tours on his boat to see local wildlife like puffins, whales or basking sharks, to visit nearby islands like Lunga, Staffa, Ulva or Muck. And he operates as a water taxi, picking up travellers like myself to visit Cull without heading all the way back to Oban for the ferry. We have left the waters of Tyree behind now. Looking back, I can still make out the island with its sandy beaches on the horizon. Ahead of me, though, is another island, one I had never even heard about before. The Isle of Gunna, a tiny island between Cull and Tyree. It is privately owned and there is only one house on the island, used as a holiday home a couple of weeks of the year. I can see dark sheep near the building, standing out clearly from the backdrop of blue sky, green grass and grey rocks. They are brought over from Cull to graze on Gunna. I wonder if they can appreciate the sheer beauty of the sandy beach that frames all three sides of the eastern tip of the island. We leave Gunna behind and are making our way up the sheltered east coast of Cull. We pass Crossapool Bay, which has the longest beach on the island, almost 2 kilometres of high dunes and fine sands. Behind it lies an RSPB nature reserve, home to rare corncrakes, waders like lapwing, redshanks and snipe, who come here to breed in the summer. And during the winter, a great spot to see barnacle and white-fronted geese. In the waters you might see otters or basking sharks, or seabirds on the hunt, puffins, razorbills, terns. At the next bay over, I spot two large buildings near the beach. They are the old and the new Breacachau Castle. The original castle was built here by the MacLeans of Col in the 15th century. The typical style of the tower house features one defensive-looking keep surrounded by multiple smaller buildings, including a round tower at one corner. It was lived in even after the newer castle was built, but abandoned sometime in the mid-19th century. The new castle, also known as Breacachau House, was constructed in the 18th century to allow for more timely living conditions. This was not uncommon at the time, as it was often easier to build a new dwelling in the style of the period rather than adjusting and modernizing existing medieval structures. However, what is unusual, at least to me, is that the new castle lies just a stone's throw from the old building, making it easy to see the different purposes these buildings once served. While the old castle seems to be a defensive stronghold first and foremost, the new castle is much more flamboyant and was clearly meant to impress by looks rather than intimidation. Col has, like many remote islands off the Scottish west coast, a small population and a rich history. The island has changed hands many times, invaded by the Irish Gaels and later the Vikings, fought over bitterly by the Norse and the Scottish clans. Eventually, the island became part of the Lordship of the Isles, and after some squabbles about inheritance, the MacLeans of Col took over the island and built a castle to defend their land. At the height of their success, Col was home to 1,000 people and supported a thriving community of farmers and fishermen. But both economy and population soon declined after the collapse of the kelp industry and the devastating potato famine. Many islanders were forced to leave and start over in Australia, Canada, or South Africa. In the end, the MacLeans sold the island, and today ownership is split between a local trust, the RSPB, and individual farmers. Less than 200 people live here today, but the population has grown over the last few decades, and the growth rate has been significantly higher than on other Scottish islands. We are now sailing past Arinagar, the largest village on the island. The large Calmac ferry, Clansman, is docked at the pier, ready to make its way back to Oban. John briefly considers dropping me off here, seeing that I booked a hotel in the village and, strictly speaking, I only booked him to transport me from Tyree to Col, but his passion for the island is too great and my appetite for adventure too big. He decides to continue north and show me more of Col by boat. Past the village, the east coast of Col is an empty land. No roads, no houses or sandy beaches, just a ragged, rocky coastline. The only exception is a tiny settlement called Sorrisdale, near the top of the island. There, John tells me stories about his childhood on the island, people who lived here in the past, those that had left, and some who returned. The house closest to the beach has been modernised and expanded. Large glass doors and floor-to-ceiling windows let the light flood inside. Sunrise must be a spectacle in this location. On the beach there are cows, licking salt off the rocks at low tide. As we move on and start turning west to make our way around the top of Col, the wind picks up again and the water becomes choppy. Out here, we are met with the unbroken force of the Atlantic Ocean, and it's brutal. Soon we are surrounded by rocky outcrops, diving in and out of sight with the rising water. White horses ride at the top of waves, breaking on these rocks. The cairns of Col. The boat, gently swaying from side to side just a few moments ago, is now tumbling from side to side, elegantly dodging the rocks. John knows these waters like the back of his hand, but I still hold on for dear life and grasp my camera with a firm hand. On the largest of the rocks, there is a small white lighthouse. It marks the location of these treacherous waters and has kept boats safe since 1909. Before that, seafarers knew to stay away from this spot, unless they possessed the kind of local knowledge John is proving today. After we pass the wildest parts of the channel and turn south towards the west coast of Col, the sea calms down again, like the waves never happened. John steers the boat in among the rocks closest to the coastline, and from this side, sandy beaches are revealed. Their fine white sand continues below the surface, colouring the shallow water of the sea in a blue-greenish tint. The scenery looks tropical. We potter along from one little beach to another, navigating the shallow bays and looking for wildlife. Seals are basking in the sunshine, unfazed by the low humming of the boat's engine. Birds are resting on the rocks, mostly seagulls, but also cormorants, spreading their wings to dry the feathers in the sun. Eventually, John cranks up the engine again and continues south towards a bay near his house. After a cup of tea, we jump into his car and drive back down to Arinagar. On the way, we meet one of the island's most famous inhabitants, a friendly Highland coo with wonky horns, one pointing up, one pointing down. No trip to Col would be complete without meeting her. I check in at Col Hotel. From my room on the first floor, I can see the sea. With a smoky dram in my hand, I watch the sky go darker and darker, until eventually the island is swallowed up by the night. You'd think my day on Col is coming to an end, but the island has one more surprise up its sleeve. The darkness is almost uncanny, especially to a city dweller like myself. There are no street lamps on the Isle of Col, and any lights on buildings must only illuminate the ground below to avoid any light pollution of the sky. The Isle of Col is a dark sky community, an area with an exceptionally clear view of the night sky and great visibility of stars. The lack of street lamps and any larger settlements makes for incredible darkness after nightfall. One just has to pray for a clear sky to see the spectacle of the universe unfold. Wrapped up in warm clothes and layers, I head out now, my camera mounted on a tripod, extra batteries in my pocket. There are a few places near the hotel that are great for stargazing. I choose to head up to the small church overlooking the village. It is pitch black, and I have to use my head torch to find my way up the rocky footpath. At the top, I set up my camera. I can see stars in the sky, but also a few clouds. My camera screen is completely dark. I can't make out a single thing that is in the frame. I set the camera to the longest possible exposure, point it towards the sky, and press the trigger. The shutter opens and light pours into the camera sensor through the lens. I stand patiently waiting, not daring to move, afraid I could disturb the process. The shutter closes. The camera processes the image, and there it is, a picture of the night sky, revealing more stars than I could ever see with the naked eye. It's a little blurry, and the angle is kind of off. I adjust the camera position slightly, this time framing the tower of the church as a point of reference. I press the trigger again, and again. Every time I do, I have to wait patiently to see the result, a sensation I'm not used to anymore. I've gotten too used to instant photography, being able to see and make adjustments instantaneously. But at night, I have to experiment and wait. Only 30 seconds, but still, with every shot, it feels like a lifetime. But the results are stunning. Just a few hours ago, Col blew me away with its rugged coastline, sandy beaches and fast-changing seas. Now, I see a different sight to the island, slowly revealing itself to me through patience and joy. But one thing is for certain. When I will depart from Kol tomorrow, I will leave a small piece of my heart behind. In its stead, I will cherish those memories of an island that takes your breath away by day and night.
I hope you enjoyed this story about my trip to the Isle of Kol. I actually got to go back to the island last summer and fell in love with it all over again. I talked about that trip in our last season, so scroll back to the episode called Healing Waters to hear a bit more about it. For travel tips, visit the link in the show notes to find my updated Isle of Kol travel guide. And now, let's get to the brand new practical part of the show. Here are my top tips for stargazing in Scotland. Tip number one, visit a dark sky place. Dark sky places are locations where darkness is a protected feature and where there is little to no light pollution from buildings, towns, or other human infrastructure. There are different types of dark sky places, like dark sky sanctuaries, dark sky parks, reserves, and communities. They differ in how they're organised, who owns the land, and just how dark the skies really get. But for all intents and purposes, it really doesn't matter that much which type of dark sky place you choose to visit. In Scotland, there are several places with official dark sky designations. For example, the dark sky parks in the Galloway Forest, or in Tomintoul and Glenlivet, the dark sky islands of Kol and North Ronaldsay in Orkney, and the dark sky town of Moffat in the south. But there are many other places with very little light pollution. Some are in the process of getting an official designation, like the Isle of Canna, while others are putting together their own guidelines, like the Wild Skies Project on Unst in Shetland. I've also seen brilliant night skies in areas that don't have official dark sky programmes. For example, just recently, I went to Findhorn on the northeast coast. Most small islands are pretty dark as well. You just need to get away from towns and settlements. Tip number two, visit when the skies are dark. This seems obvious, but the best time to go stargazing in Scotland is when the skies actually get dark. Our days are so long here in the summer that it barely gets dark at all. Up north, dusk might just shift straight into dawn without proper darkness. The best months to visit are from October to late March. It also depends a little bit on what you want to see. The Milky Way, for example, is most visible in autumn or fall, and the northern lights tend to show up more frequently at the start and at the end of dark season. I'd also look at forecasts for shooting stars or any special planetary events. I've collected some useful links about this in our full show notes on the website. Tip number three, remember the moon and the clouds. Unfortunately, darkness isn't all you require for stargazing in Scotland. You also need clear skies. Two things that can stand in the way are the moon, especially when it's full or nearly full, and cloud cover. Now, if you have a cloud covering up the moon, but clear skies for the rest of it, you've basically won the lottery. Otherwise, try to time your stargazing trip around the time of a new moon, and head out for multiple nights to increase your chances of a good view. Tip number four, stay warm out there. When you're out stargazing, you're not necessarily moving a lot. That's why it's important to wrap up warm, bring layers, and a flask with a hot drink, or if you're not driving, a wee dram to enjoy. Stargazing can be tough on your neck, so I recommend bringing a blanket so you can lie down and look straight up into the sky. But make sure the blanket has some insulation to keep you dry and warm. Another key thing is not to pollute your own vision with light. Get a headlamp with a red light setting, as that will allow your eyes to adjust better to the darkness. And avoid looking at bright screens like your phone or camera. Speaking of photography, there are tons of tips out there for dark sky photography, and I'll add a few to our full show notes. Tip number 5. Get help from an expert. The dark sky experiences I've enjoyed the most were usually accompanied by a guide, someone who can point out star constellations and planets and tell stories about mythology and folklore. That way, even if you don't see as much, you walk away with new stories and memories to tell. Most of the official dark sky places in Scotland have trained dark sky rangers, or they offered guided dark sky events that can last one evening or several days. These often happen in October, November, or March time. Another benefit is that dark sky experts often have access to specialist equipment, like big astronomical telescopes. These are great to see stars in places where the naked eye only sees dark spots in the sky. I'll never forget the first time I looked through such a telescope. It really changed the way I see the night sky. And with this, I send you off to dream about your own stargazing trip to the Isle of Col or one of the other dark sky places in Scotland. I'm taking a break from podcasting at the moment because I'm writing an outdoor guidebook about Scotland, and I'm putting everything into place for a new season of Wild for Scotland, which will hopefully air later this year. If you join our Patreon community, the Wild for Scotland Social Club, you'll soon get to hear an exclusive bonus episode though, which is an extended interview about archaeology in the Scottish Borders with Michelle Gamble and Ian Hill. Head to patreon.com/wildforscotland or find the link to join in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to Wild for Scotland. We love telling stories that are truly inspiring, so if any of our episodes have ever inspired you to visit a certain location, support a sponsor, or change something about the way you look at the world, we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review or post about it on social media and tag us. Wild for Scotland is part of the Tremula Network, adventure and outdoor podcasts off the beaten path. The show is written and hosted by me, Kathy Kamleitner. Thanks to Fran Turowskis, who is the co-producer and editor, and does the sound design. Podcast art is by Lizzie Vaughan Knight, the Tartan Trailburner, and all original music is composed by Bruce Wallace. Until next time, when we travel to a different place in Scotland. If you're still here, listening all the way to the very end, it means you've probably got your hands full. So let me take this opportunity to remind you that I don't just write immersive travel stories. I also plan unforgettable itineraries for Scotland, and it's never been easier to follow one of my routes. Head to watchmesee.com/shop to browse my ready-made Scotland itineraries and turn your travel dreams into reality.